1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 2 to 16. Now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, but every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. For a man was not made for woman, but woman for man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That is why a wife ought not to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord woman is not independent of man, nor man a woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him, but if a woman has long hair, it is her glory? For her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God.
Thank you. Thanks so much for reading, and welcome here. Particularly, I can see there's some visitors here, maybe down for a bank holiday, so really welcome here with us. I'm Charlie. I'm one of the, one of the elders here at the church. Does it matter how I pray? I guess maybe when you saw that on the cards, you thought this would be a series about, does it matter whether you kneel? Does it matter whether I'm familiar with God or formal with God? Does it matter if I say thee or thou? I guess probably looking at the card, you didn't think it would be about what you wear on your head, which is the verses we just had read. Certainly not that it might be about how men and women relate entirely. So in Royal Wedding Week, to have a passage all about marriage, that's good, that's appropriate, isn't it? Except it's this one. I think everybody has a favourite bit of the Bible, and I'd be willing to bet this is no one's, these verses here. Paul is telling women in Corinth to cover their heads in church. And his reasons, they sound scandalous to modern ears, don't they? I was kind of looking around to see how many eyebrows raised there'd be as the passage was read. Maybe you are down here for the weekend. Come and see what kind of church your family are coming to. It's a sexist church, clearly. One of the things we believe in here is that it's best to go through the Bible in the order it's written, leaving nothing out. So we're going through 1 Corinthians. And to be honest, I would far rather leave this out. If I was choosing my favourite bits, we'd go years and years and years before we reached 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 2 to 16. But actually, by going through everything, we have to talk about and tackle everything that's here. So that's what we're going to try and do today. And I started wondering how many women here would leave Euston Church if we said you had to come in a head covering. I wonder how many people would do that. I wonder how many men would leave if we said the women had to come in a head covering. We've got used over the last few months, if you've been here, to 1 Corinthians being very pushy, very controversial. So in chapter 8, he told them to all go veggie. In chapter 5, he said that sex was only for within marriage. And then in chapter 7, he told them to stay single. And now this time it's raising huge issues of how men and women relate. And just, we may have said this before, but just to underline here, with each of those issues, when there's an issue in the Bible that is that big and that controversial, it sort of asks you, where is your line? Where is the line up to which the Bible's allowed to have influence in your life? And where is the line kind of beyond where it's gone too far? What sort of things is the Bible allowed to tell you to do? It's a test of your view of the Bible, really. So I guess if we could kind of summon up God and stood him in the room there, and he was in the corner of the room, would he be allowed to tell you to do things like that? Would he be able to say, stop having sex with them? Or
stack off the bacon or wear a head covering? And most people would say yes. That's kind of something that goes with being God's. You're in charge and you're allowed to tell people what to do. So the question when we face a chapter like this is, what is the Bible? What sort of book is it? What do we think about it? And in particular, do you think that this book, rightly understood, rightly applied, is like having God in the room? Is God speaking? That's the way Chris introduced it. Which we'll feel really sharply tonight, I think, because we're used to the idea that God might tell us not to have sex with certain people and that sort of thing. But insisting that women wear something on their heads in church, that is for the loonies and the repressives, isn't it? Though actually, and those churches do still exist. I don't know if anyone here grew up in or has been part of churches where women would have to wear something on their head. The most recent talk I heard on this, I went on to a big conference and heard someone speaking on a platform, and he mentioned this, and he was having a real go at, kind of making fun of women who did kind of think they have to wear something on their head, and he was mocking the particular kind of head, and he said it's like a doily on their head, and he was chatting about this, and I noticed that 6 feet behind him, sitting at the piano, was a woman wearing exactly what he was talking about. She'd just been playing all the songs, wanted to kind of, she's behind you! So it still exists, and he was just being rude. Instinctively we say, someone reads 1 Corinthians 11, wants to wear something on their head, they should be allowed to. And yet, I did check, nobody here is. No woman here is wearing something on their head. There's a couple of little hair clips, but I'm not sure that counts. Even though the Bible says that you should in our reading. I don't know, have you ever had a Muslim friend take you to this chapter and say, how come Christians are inconsistent? How come you don't wear a burqa or a veil at least? And the answer, of course, is in rightly understanding and rightly applying. So there'll be lots of people here who do believe the Bible is God's word, believe it's God speaking, believe that he could tell us to do anything. But to know what he is telling us, we need to check we're understanding it right. And this evening in particular, we need to talk a little bit about culture, how we move from the culture then to the culture today, how you go from a cultural context then and apply something rightly in our cultural context. So before we come to 1 Corinthians 11, I want to just show us how to do that with an easier example, which if some of you were on the weekend away before last, you'll know this already. But we're going to do a warm-up in 1 Thessalonians 5. There's a reference on the very long and detailed handout. Please turn there if you want to. Everyone except Kevin Joel, please don't turn there. Okay, is that all right? It's just over there. Thank you. So it's 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 26, perfectly straightforward part of the Bible. So has anyone got a page number? Got a page number? I'll drop my notes later. 1190. Thank you, Audrey. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read the verse, and then Kevin Joel will stand, and we will all watch them put that into practice. Okay? So if you're ready. So this is 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 26. God is in the room. God is speaking. It says, greet all the brothers with a holy kiss. If you would now please stand up and put that verse into practice. There we go. Thank you very much. Now, what do you think? Why didn't they kiss? I've never seen anybody kiss in an English church, or any two men kiss in an English church. Why didn't they kiss? Because of, thank you very much, you were worried for a second, because of cultural context. So in New Testament times, two men kissing would have been a completely normal way of greeting each other, would have been a completely normal way of saying hello. The command in the verse is greet each other, and the kind of cultural add to it is greet each other warmly, friendly, don't be standoffish. Normal to kiss each other, so kiss. But cultures change. And if two men kiss today, that says a bit more than hello in the UK. Elsewhere in the world, it would be exactly like New Testament times. So to obey that verse properly, you have to read from their culture through to ours and obey the principle in the way that's appropriate. So Kevin Joel shook hands. I think that's about the best we can do in England for the equivalent of what that verse means. Same thing in Corinth. Covering your head, if you were female, communicated something. It had a very definite meaning. It expressed something. So as well as asking what is it Paul's telling them to do in Corinth, in the first century, we also need to ask how to do that in our culture today. Is that okay? We sort of warmed up, ready for the verses. So turn back to 1 Corinthians, and let me just remind you very briefly where we are in the letter, if you've not been with us. Corinth is an arrogant church. They think they are the best church. They might even put if they've kind of been into church billboards like we are today, might have put a sign outside saying the best church in the world. They competed for them. Going to church was an opportunity to show off about how wise you were or how gifted you were, how much closer to God you were than other people. And Paul has just been knocking that down chapter by chapter. That is not what being a Christian is all about. So if you're back there, chapter 10, verses 32 and 33 are his basic medicine, how to behave. Give no offence to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God. But instead of giving offence, I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, that they may be saved. Live your life for the advantage of other people. And the last time we were in 1 Corinthians, we had three chapters of how to do that in society in general. So what do you do when you're in the pub, you're out for a meal, you're in the marketplace, you're round at a friend's house? How do you live your life as a Christian for the advantage of other people? And we're now going to get, we'll pause it and come back to it slightly later in the year, four chapters of how do you live for other people's advantage in church. So does it matter how I pray? Yes. You still need to pray in a way that is advantageous to other people. Causes no offence, does good to other people. And it's not too bad in Corinth on this, actually. Verse 2 of chapter 11 is the most positive verse in the whole book, almost. In general, their church meetings are okay. But still, in our verses today, there is an area where they are giving offence, in particular to Greeks, I think, maybe to Jews as well. They're giving offence from the way that people are dressing, and the women in particular are dressing. And it's interesting, in the marketplace chapters, you had to think about other Christians who might see what you're doing in the marketplace and be worried. Well, now in church, maybe even especially in church, you need to think about people who are watching and what they will think. The sort of engine words in the chapter, have you heard them? They're all about social judgments. They're all about what will people think. So dishonor in verse 4 and verse 5. Or disgrace in verse 6 or verse 14. Or glory, the opposite, verse 7 or verse 15. And verse 13, the question is it proper? It sounds very old-fashioned to us, but the sort of what was your society make of what you're doing? What will they say about it? There are lots and lots of weird, complicated things in these verses. In the time we've got, going to try and take us through the most important. One of the verses that's hardest is verse 10. And I think, though, a sort of social judgment background is the best way to understand the end of the verse. So verse 10, wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels, which doesn't really sound like a reason, does it? Because of the angels doing what? Why do the angels care what she's wearing? And you'll see in the footnote number 3 at the bottom, the word angel is the same word as messengers. And the ESV, the translation goes as far as it possibly can to kind of suggest what this is all about. It says, that is, people sent to observe and report. So a messenger doesn't have to be from you to other people. And in Corinth at the time, though this may not be it, there were sort of religious fashion police who would go to religious ceremonies, look for people who were inappropriately dressed, immodestly dressed, and kind of pull them out and send them home to change. And so maybe that's the sort of situation. People coming in and bringing back a report about the church. Word will get out what the women wear in church. Not in a kind of, was the dress by Alexander McQueen kind of way. But if social rules are being broken, people will know and it will affect the way people feel about the gospel. So the principle is don't give offence to society, even in your church meetings. You're not as private as you think. It's not just a family gathering. So be careful what you wear. Which means that the passage could be entirely cultural, couldn't it? If that's what it is, don't give offence. Hatless women offended them then, so they had to put the hats on. Whereas now, nobody's offended by women not wearing hats, so it doesn't matter. In fact, one commentary said, these verses are not about a theology of gender, they're just about correcting one worship practice. which is obviously very attractive, isn't it? If we could say this is just about one worship practice in a cultural background then we can effectively put 1 Corinthians 11 aside. Say our culture doesn't have the same problem, so we don't need to do it anymore. But the trouble is, I think Paul does much, much more here than just say put your hat on. He corrects the worship practice by appealing to his theology of gender. He argues from the theology of gender that he spends quite a lot of verses on here, through to what you should do and wear in your culture. That's his big reason why they should go along with their culture, actually. And if the Bible is God speaking, then this is God's presumably good, well-intentioned understanding of men and women, and his understanding for all time, though the way it kind of works out in culture may change. His arguments, they go back to creation. Did you pick that up? They go back to Genesis and how men and women were made. And they also appeal to the Trinity, how God relates in the Trinity. Again, something else that doesn't change. So let's have a look through at his arguments and see how it all works. Point one, just from verse 3, is that men and women have different heads. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Which is a massively controversial thing to say, isn't it? So the big headlines about Kate, the Duchess of Cambridge, refusing to say obey, you have to say it would have been a bigger shock, wouldn't it, if she had. But imagine the horror if somebody had read this verse at the wedding. Kate had said, this is what I think about how men and women relate. But the verses are saying there are differences between men and women, and that at least in marriage, the husband is the head of the wife in a similar way that Jesus is over a man, or God the Father is over Jesus. And you can imagine with a verse like that, there has been lots and lots of effort put into understanding exactly what it is saying, checking it really means what it sounds like it means. It's especially hot in the Church of England, in our denomination, because of big decisions about women bishops at the moment. So lots and lots has been written. I'm going to recommend a couple of books in a second. Are men and women the same and intended for the same roles, or are they different? Should there be differences? So I just want to look a little bit at the options on this verse, the kind of things that people have said about it, because I imagine you may well have come across them, may well have read this stuff and think it, may well want to talk to me about it, or may well come across it. So two issues in particular, they're on the handout and the references are there. First of all, what does head mean? So in English, the verse we just read, and the head of a wife is her husband, has an inescapable sense of authority to it, doesn't it? To say that, this is what I think that a man is the head of a woman, has an inescapable sense of you're saying there's an authority relationship. But people have asked, it's an excellent question, did it mean that then? That's a very good question to ask of something in the Bible, just because it sounds like it means something in English. Did it mean that then? And one suggestion you may have come across is that head just means source. That it's saying that the husband is the source of the wife, not the head of the wife. The thing to read on this, I haven't actually got with me because I haven't bought it. It's free online. It's a book by Wayne Grudem that you can download and have for free. And articles in the back of it, the kind of appendix to it, includes his reasonably long and slightly dull list of all the ways this word is ever used in Greek literature, the word for head. So normally it just means head, in a perfectly straightforward, he shaved his head or cut off his head kind of way. But they can use it metaphorically, and he's looked up all of those ways and listed them. And the argument for source goes two ways. It says the word can be used as source. For instance, it can mean the source of a river. And also argues from biology then. So nowadays we know the brain sits in the head and the brain makes the decisions, but they didn't know that. And they thought the head was the source of everything the body needed. We'll see that in Colossians 2, verse 19, when we look there. But you need to look for yourself. But I think Grudem's done all the work to show actually that in every single case, the word always has an authority sense, even when it might mean source. Where it could do, where it's between people. So it only ever means source of a river because it means the kind of bits that stick out either end. So a river has a head and a feet and toes, and that you could call either end that, the source and the mouth, or the mouth and the source. And it's just saying sticks out at the end. And more importantly, it's where it's used of people, Even if it's trying to say there's a kind of source-type relationship, it always carries with it a role that involves authority. So in Colossians 2, verse 19, the head isn't just nourishing the body, it is Jesus, the head, in his role, and that the problem is that people are trying to break away from his authority. So if we could look at a few of the references on the sheet, just turn to Ephesians and the references we've got there. And that is page 1175. So in Ephesians 1:22, there is the word he puts, God put all things under Jesus' feet and gave him as head over all things for the church. And if you look at the context of it, it's really clear this is a head as we'd understand it in English. God has raised him, verse 20, seated him at the right hand on the throne. And verse 21, that is about rule and authority and power and dominion and all things, verse 22. Are under his feet, which is a key Old Testament idea, the kind of ruler of the whole world. So when we meet the word in chapter 4, verse 15, where it has a much more kind of nourishing source kind of sense, emphasizes a connection between the head and growth. The head there is still Jesus Christ, with the authority carried across from chapter 1. He is the Lord in verse 4 and verse 5. Who ascended with captives, verse 8, the same picture, the one who rules over everything. He's the one who's the head in chapter 4. And it's clear again even in chapter 5 when it begins talking about husbands and wives. Chapter 5, verse 23 is the most similar verse to our chapter 11 verse in the New Testament. It says, the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body. And the context is submit, verse 24. Because the husband is the head, so the wife submits to the husband as the church submits to Christ. And submit is the word that Claire, my wife, said at the wedding in place of obey, because we thought obey just carried so many overtones of tyranny and that sort of thing. But it's still pretty controversial, isn't it, to say submit. It was enough for my aunt to kind of nearly fall off her pew at it. Colossians, the references are very similar. And the head is the one who rules over all creation. So the source, and the fact that it can mean source, and the fact that they understood head to be to do with nourishment, is helpful because it reminds us that abusive authority is never what the New Testament is recommending. Tyranny and selfishness, that is not any part of human biology. The heads work for the good of their body. In fact, if you're still in Ephesians 5, you'll see the husband is told to love his wife and give himself up for her like Christ did for the church. There's no sort of fat man on a sofa giving orders to his wife here. This is Jesus dying on a cross because he wants to look after his body, the church. But even if the source meaning is there strongly, it's still an authority word. We're still talking about a difference between men and women. Second thing on the sheet, the second area people have gone to work on this verse is to do with the last part of the verse, back in 1 Corinthians, that the husband is the head of the wife as God is the head of Christ. Which is really important. So here's the best way to hold together, I think, all the biblical material on men and women. It's to say something like this. It's to say men and women are created equal. And they are both in the image of God. In fact, you cannot have the image of God without men and women. They are of equal status and equal value. And yet, the Bible says, they have different roles. Where the man's role is to take the lead, though that doesn't make him any more important, and the woman's role is to submit to his leadership. And to my ears, growing up with a kind of normal 20th century feminist assumptions, that just sounds like nonsense. Equal, but with different roles. One's the leader. Yeah, right, that's equal. That doesn't sound like equal. Which is where the end of Paul's verse is very important. Because God the Father and God the Son are equal. And yet, 1 Corinthians 11 verse 3 says that one of them is the head of the other. It's crucially important, actually, for almost everything in theology, that the God, the Father and the Son are equal. Both are gods, both equal in status, both equal in being, in essence, and yet they have different roles. It's the father who takes the lead, though that doesn't make him any more important. And it's the son's role to submit to his leadership. And even as you read the New Testament, you see the son delights in that, thinks it's brilliant. And when, I don't know how that strikes you, when I first heard some of the Bible's teaching on men and women, I was 15, first time I heard a talk on this, and I thought it was hugely sexist. I kind of huffed my way out of the room, sat down for lunch at a table full of people, expected everybody to agree with me that we'd just heard the most scandalous and repressive load of nonsense. And it was the people I'd sat with, who were nearly all female and were all very bright, very articulate, friends of mine. I knew them well. I knew the sort of, they weren't going to kind of push over for an argument, who said, actually, we believe what's just been said. We think that's what the Bible says. And more than that, said, we think this is good. Hard sometimes to get your head around, hard to kind of cheerfully believe, but still good and liberating. And that there's a good reason why God said it. So because the Trinity is such a good example of how this could work, how you could have equal people who submit to each other, there have also been attempts to say the Trinity doesn't really work like that. So I don't know if you've come across those, to say that isn't what the Trinity's like. So just very briefly, some verses on the sheet again. On the earth, it's really clear that is exactly how it operates. So let me take you to John 6. I could read it if we don't want to turn them up. John 6, verse 38. Jesus says, I've come down from earth not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. Jesus' summary of his whole life. The most significant, important, equal with God person says, everything I do is God's will, not mine. Even Mark 14, when that disagrees with what he wants to do, when he really, really doesn't want to do what his father wants him to do, to die on the cross, he says, not your will, but my will. It's a good indication that submit doesn't mean sort of cheerful smile and whatever you say, dear. This Jesus really argues with his father for hours, but then does submit. So people say maybe it's just the way things were between God the Father and God the Son while he was on earth. Maybe this isn't really how it works in the Trinity. So the John 17 reference takes us to before Jesus became a man. But turn to 1 Corinthians 15, because that will get us at least back in the right book to carry on. 1 Corinthians 15, where you have the same head picture that we get in Ephesians. So verse 25, he must reign until he puts all his enemies under his feet. There's even the same Old Testament idea quoted, verse 27, all things under his feet. But then at the end of time, verse 28, the Son turns to the Father and is made subject to him. The picture in the Trinity is of a Jesus who does everything his Father says, and delights in handing the kingdom over to his father. They're equal, but the son submits to the father. So sorry, that's a very long-winded way of saying, I think, I'm afraid, if you find it difficult, 1 Corinthians 11 verse 3 does mean what it sounds like it means. You may not like it. As I said, I hated it the first time I heard it, but that is what it says. It's arguing for a genuine equality, but with a difference in who has the head role. And it may sound very old-fashioned, but it's back to that question of who actually, who is in charge. Not a preacher, certainly not a male preacher, but is God, if this is what the Bible really says, is God able to say what we should do, or is our culture in charge? And I said I'd give you two books to read. The one is this one, which is just out, to be really helpful for the series in total, called True Spirituality, Vaughan Roberts, just going through 1 Corinthians. So there'll be a chapter on 1 Corinthians chapter 11. There'll be lots of helpful stuff in there for all of 1 Corinthians. And then on this issue particularly, I found this book really, really helpful. It's called The Gender Agenda by Liz Goddard and Claire Hendry. Two women in ordained ministry in the Church of England coming from opposite points of view on this issue. Both evangelicals, both friends both work together. Claire Hendry taught me at Bible College. And just a good model, both of going through all the important passages as a good conversation, but also sort of staying friendly as they talk about the issue. So that would be a good book to get hold of. If it's okay, I think for sake of time, let's just have a look now at how Paul applies it then. I'll give you a few ideas of how I think that should apply now. So verse 3 is his basic statement about men and women. Point 2, and we will go much quicker now, he says, so your behaviour now should reflect God's intention in the creation of men and women. So he's not just saying do whatever your culture tells you to. If your culture says be bad to women, just do it because then they'll like you. He's also not saying you've got to stick with one particular cultural expression and never change. So Muslims who say you need to dress like Muhammad and wear your beard just like him, that's not what this is saying. It's not that you have to stay in the culture Christianity began in. He is saying you do the Bible principle in whatever way your culture will understand it. You translate it into the language of your culture. So 1 Thessalonians again, if you're in an unfriendly culture like Britain, it's not okay to be unfriendly. I know overseas students and visitors will say you're just unfriendly. And there's an extent to which that's true, isn't it? And 1 Thessalonians 5 verse 26 says, challenge your culture. You must greet each other in a friendly way. Be friendly. But you don't need to kiss if your culture would understand that differently. You translate, and you translate that into your culture. You shake hands warmly and you mean it, and you take an interest in people. So verses 4 to 6, the clear issue is women ceasing to wear something on their heads that the culture expected them to wear. I think that is probably because the gospel had come as such a blast of fresh air to the women in the church with the cultural context they were labouring under. A huge raise in status that the biblical principles we just outlined give them. So we hear them as a reduction in status. To them it was a huge raise in status. You are allowed to pray and prophesy. We want to hear what you have to say. That was certainly in Jewish synagogue terms, that was radically different. You are equal. Men are not better than you. You are equal in status and value. These were huge changes. And it looks like the women were kind of going with that. This is great. And throwing off literally everything in their culture that seemed to go in that direction. And probably the thing they were taking off their heads was the thing that said they were married. The cultural thing that says they're married. And cultural archaeologically is really difficult. But probably, as an unmarried woman, you'd wear a kind of shawl around your neck. And when you got married, you'd draw it over your head. And that was the out in public sign that you were a married person. Which Paul says, if you don't wear it, verse 5, you dishonour your head, meaning your husband, I think there. Your head as not your kind of own head, but your metaphorical head, your husband. She is, as she takes off the head covering, says, I break free of marriage and its restrictions. She is saying more to her culture than the Bible principles would let her. You're not free of your relationship with your husband. And actually, if your culture has some things about marriage right, biblically, you need to fit in and wear the cultural marker that says that. And it's clear that the culture cared a lot about it. Verse 5 and verse 6, the shaving head stuff, he's not recommending that as a kind of better option. Kind of go all Kate Beckinsale, get the short hair. That was their punishment for adulterers. You would be kind of taken and your head would be shaved. He's saying, actually, you're communicating to your culture something that is as shocking, as shameful as if all of you shaved your heads. Verse 10 is much harder to understand, as I said. My best guess is it's arguing for the same thing again. It's a symbol of husband's authority that she's taking off her head. The other option is it's a symbol of her own freedom to pray and prophesy. And he gives some extra reasons, verse 7, 8, 9. They're all from the Garden of Eden. They're all from the world without sin. They're all from the way God set things up. And I don't think I understand all the mechanisms. I have no idea how me not wearing a hat communicates glory to Jesus. No idea. I don't know what the mechanism there. No idea how a woman's hat gave glory to her husband, unless it is just it's the marker of I'm married and I respect that. But the reasons are pan-cultural, aren't they? Cross-cultural. Verse 8, who was made first? Verse 9, who was made for whom? And we don't have time to go over that in detail. Go back to Genesis 2, you'll realize this isn't made for as in as my slave, but as companion. in a wonderful close relationship, a partnership, that yes, has an order within it, an order of role.
So applying this today is very hard because, the principle is that the way we order our church, our families, our relationships, it should reflect the way that God set up things between men and women. We shouldn't seek to undermine in what we wear and how we behave the principles of the way God thinks set that up. In fact, we should wear and do the kind of things that will reinforce the way God set things up. But hats just don't do that anymore. If you wore a hat to church, nobody would think that was saying anything about men and women or husbands or anything, which is why we have no such rule. If you're still hanging on from the beginning of the sermon, or if we are going to insist in hats from now on, we're not planning to. I think that's right. No plan like that. In fact, in our culture, it's almost the exact way around. The question in verse 13, is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Unanimously, our culture would say yes. And verse 14, does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it's a disgrace for him? Unanimously, our culture would say no. Nature there meaning, I think, so anthropology, what men in general society did then. And our culture has changed. There's a reference to 1 Timothy 2 on the sheet where it says you're not allowed to wear gold or pearls. And the reasons are the same, given it's not proper to wear gold or pearls. The biblical principle is you should dress respectfully, modestly, under self-control. And because then, gold and pearls meant, apparently, prostitutes. So you wore gold and pearls and braided hair to communicate that's who you were. And married, sort of respectable women didn't wear them. But what do you do if culture changes or flips? So apparently in Venice in the Middle Ages, gold and pearls, the only people allowed to wear gold and pearls were married people. And the people who didn't wear gold and pearls that you'd meet were the prostitutes. So if you apply 1 Timothy 2 then and say all the Christians must wear gold and pearls, that's going to get a little bit awkward. So you apply the principle in culture's way. So I don't know, I'm not sure it's dress now. I think our cultural markers, to the extent there are any anymore, are about the surname you take. I don't know, I don't mean to be over-controversial, but where if somebody doesn't take their husband's surname because they want to communicate, I'm independent of this man, I'm my own person, he has no authority over me. I think that gets quite close. I think maybe the Mrs. does the same. Again, there could be excellent professional reasons, again, for keeping a surname or using Ms. I don't want to kind of judge a particular person for what they've done. I think it also is in how we speak about marriage and gender and how, if we're married, how we make decisions as a couple, how we talk about those decisions. You know, I'm doing this because I really don't want to. And how we speak about our spouse, actually, would be the sort of ways this would apply to a woman in our culture today. But I want to finish with point three. We're not going to get to point four. That doesn't make men superhuman. It doesn't make men superior to women. So verse 11 and 12, nevertheless, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. And he makes the very good biological point that Adam, Eve may have come out of Adam, but ever since then, every single man, verse 12, has come out of woman. We're connected. The mutuality that chapter 7 talks about in marriage, where each owns each other, each does things for the good of the other, chapter 11 isn't undoing that. So I think if verses 4 to 10 are hard for women to hear and apply, verses 11 and 12 actually men need to hear and to apply. Men, do you carry with you even subconsciously, a sort of sense of superiority over women, a sense of self-importance from being a man. We think our culture is over this, but the number of families who still would rather have a boy than a woman, even in parts of the world, would kill the baby girls because a man would be more important. Even if you say, no, that's not me, I think still there's a big culture of sort of casual sexism among men, kind of count the jokes used. The way it's okay to talk. Interesting, been reading a little bit of kind of feminist history and literature and background for this. Sort of really good point one of them made was why are men not cross? Why are particularly kind of conservative theological men not cross about wife abuse and trafficking for prostitution and the kind of objectification of women in the way women and girls are encouraged to dress? Is it actually because there's a sense that men think women are less important and kind of think the theology of verse 3
is somehow allowing us to say it. And interesting, given the principle is you don't want to give offence to your culture, and you want to live out the Bible principle in the right way that your culture will understand, well, their culture was maybe more repressive to women in the Bible. Our culture is more liberated, probably, to women in that sense than the Bible. So men need to be extra careful not to give offence in the way they put verse 3 into practice. So sort of cultural markers of husbands not being tyrants and not pretending to be and not joking about being, not sort of taking advantage of the Bible's teaching here. So this concludes the chapter here. So this week we've seen understanding a bit of the gospel made them change their culture too much. Next week we'll see where they haven't changed enough. But in both cases, it's not just sort of just to overthrow society. In both cases, his aim is to get you to be a Christian for the advantage of others. Live your life not necessarily to grasp the greatest freedom for these women here, to get rid of the thing they hated wearing on their heads. Live for the advantage of others. Don't give offence to your culture. Stay with what the Bible said. I think the same thing as I said to husbands and to men now. Don't live for the advantage of yourself. Live so that the gospel could be most clearly understood and not a scandal in the culture. Let me finish by praying. Father God, thank you for your word, even when it's challenging, even when it's hard to understand. Father, please help us, men and women, as we talk together and discuss what's in your word and how to apply it. Give us love, give us patience, give us a desire, Lord, to know what your word really says, that we'd examine for ourselves, we'd search the scriptures, and then that we would live as our conscience and your word instructs, and we'd ask your help to joyfully live the way that you have ordered the world. In Jesus' name, amen.